For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. Okay, it's time to introduce our regular guest, the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture human rights lawyer, former head of the International Committee of Human Rights. I think that's the New York Bar Association one. He's a professor at Columbia and Hofstra Universities. He's the legal affairs correspondent for Harper's Magazine. If you look at their website, you'll find his great blog, No Comment, at, I believe it is, if I page up on my page here, harpers.org/subjects/no comment. Welcome back to the show, Scott. How are you?
Hey, great to be with you.
I'm really happy to have you here. We've got very important news to cover. As we all know, as we've talked about on this show numerous times in the past, the rule of law in America is dead, but in Italy, it lives on. Is it true? Can it really be true?
I think so, yeah. It is pretty amazing. In fact, it's also interesting that we have two of the leading newspapers in the United States, the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, writing major feature editorials saying Italian justice understands what justice is about. Now, why don't the Americans learn something from that?
The New York Times wrote that?
New York yesterday. Absolutely. Big editorial.
Wow. Okay. So tell us the story. First of all, what happened in Italy? And then let's get into the court case here.
Well, the story goes back to 2003. But, you know, to understand it, you need to understand the Extraordinary Renditions Program that was set up by the CIA towards the beginning of the George W. Bush presidency. It involved targeting people who were suspected terrorists, snatching them off the ground wherever they were in the world, dragging them to so-called black sites, these special CIA-run prisons, or turning them over to prisons with cooperating foreign intelligence services. You know, we don't know exactly who all those cooperating foreign intelligence services were, but there are quite a few of them. And one of the early projects in this program involved an Egyptian cleric named Abu Omar. And he had fled Egypt, and he'd gotten political asylum in Milan. He was living there. And in retrospect, it's really difficult to understand why this guy was targeted. In fact, I've spoken with a couple of people close to the agency recently, and they've acknowledged that this guy never really was a legitimate terrorism target. It was suspected that they would be able to get him, scare him, shake him up a little bit, and then get him to turn and be a spy for the CIA inside some of these terrorist organizations.
So he got the Randy Weaver treatment. Either be a snitch or we're going to persecute you.
That's right. I mean, they felt that he had developed good connections so that he could go inside if he wanted to and become a member and spy for them.
You know what? That's what they did to Jose Padilla, too, isn't it? Wasn't it an FBI? I had forgotten that part of that story, but one of the FBI agents said, we knew Padilla wasn't a threat. We knew he wasn't a terrorist. We wanted to flip him. We wanted to use him to entrap others, and he refused.
And
so they gave him the full on.
That's right. And that's also the same thing with a large number of the journalists who were seized in Iraq, one of whom was held in Guantanamo. When they subsequently were freed and were debriefed, they all said, yeah, we were told that that the CIA or the intelligence service wanted us to spy, to start with, to spy on our news agency. Well, in this case, they wanted Abu Omar, so they launched this massive plan, and they deployed some 24 agents to Italy. These people were there for more than a month, tracking this guy's every move every day, figuring out, you know, where he had his morning coffee and where he shopped for his groceries and all his habits. And then the day came and they snatched the guy in the middle of a street in Milan, downtown Milan, put him in the back of a van, drove him off to Aviano Air Force Base, which is just outside of Venice, an American Air Force Base. And from there, he was put on a jet going to Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany, also another American Air Force Base. And from Ramstein, he was put on another jet, sending him to Egypt, where he was turned over to Egyptian intelligence. And he was held by the Egyptians, I think, in a cooperative arrangement between the CIA and the Egyptians, for more than a year, during which time he was really brutally tortured, beaten, electroshocked, whipped. When he was finally released a year later, he was so physically disabled he couldn't walk without a cane and suffered kidney failure and all sorts of other problems. But in fact, they concluded at the end of all this, this guy was a nobody. He really didn't have any serious connections to any terrorist organizations, and he wasn't willing to turn and spy for them. But then the problems of the CIA really began to set in because the Italians, it turns out, had been tracking this guy. They had suspected that he might be a terrorist. They were spying on him and trying to put together their own criminal case against him. And when he suddenly disappeared, the Italian counterterrorism police got very suspicious about what happened. They began to track it. They opened a criminal investigation. And pretty quickly they figured out that he had been, and here's the word, kidnapped by the CIA.
Well, and wasn't part of this, and this is a very minor point, but I think I remember that. It was like the most ridiculous Keystone Cop sort of CIA thing where they put coke and whores in the most expensive hotels and a tour down the river and everything they wanted on their company credit card, and it was the most obvious thing in the world, right?
Absolutely right. Milt Bearden, you know, very famous CIA, leading CIA figure who's been a consultant in a whole slew of CIA spy movies in Hollywood lately, said he couldn't believe it when he read the account of what was going on there. He called it the Keystone Cops. He said it was so crudely done and violating all the rules. He was just astonished. But what happened is you had two dozen CIA agents in Italy deciding that this wasn't a CIA operation. It was a vacation. So these people on taxpayer expense were staying in five-star hotels, eating lavish meals at the finest restaurants, ordering vintage wine, renting luxury automobiles, taking tours around the countryside on vacation, and using cell phones to communicate back and forth. So in short, what were they doing? They were leaving a trail for anyone who was seriously going to investigate this to track. And that's exactly what happened. In fact, I did a long interview with Armando Spataro, the chief prosecutor who handled the case, and he told me, he said, basically the CIA did themselves in. They gave us early on in this program through a cooperation agreement this very, very fancy software that allows us, if I get one person's cell phone, I can punch it in and I can draw up all sorts of information about who this person's called and track down who those people are. I can track down their credit card use and everything else. He said, you know, this is the first case we have where we actually use this fancy software, and it allowed us to track down every single one of these CIA agents and all their moves. And in fact, I understand the Italians are continuing to track the Americans who are involved even after they return back to the States. They know where these people have camped out. They know information about their new cover names, their new cover employments, and everything else. They're waiting to pounce.
Well, so I got a point of confusion here. Is Italy not a satellite of the American Empire? Does it not, as you already just described, have American military bases throughout it? How can it possibly be that they would that a prosecutor there would dare to challenge our rule? You know what it reminds me of? That movie Amistad, where it's the I think Spanish ambassador says, well, why don't you just, tell the judge what to do? And the president says, I'm really sorry. I know it's a real pain, but we have this independent judiciary here, and I can't really make them do what I want. It's the complete inverse now, where the old world is applying the law, even though we're now the empire over their land.
Well, that's right. In fact, I think one of the amazing things here is that nobody can credibly say Armando Spataro, the prosecutor here, is anti-American. To the contrary, he's one of the most Americanophile persons, Italians, I've ever run into. He loves American jazz music. He spends his vacation time in Montana. He says his favorite city in the world outside of Milan is Chicago. You know, he speaks very good English. He's a very, very pro-American figure. And what's going on in this case basically is the enforcement of American principles of law. You know, the whole idea that drives this case is a view of the law that was put forward by American prosecutors in 1946 to 1948 at the end of World War II, where, you know, we, the United States, took the position that if a government seizes someone and they hold them outside of accountability under the law and they torture them, we took the view That's a crime against humanity, and there is no statute of limitations, and it's a particularly serious kind of crime.
And even now it prescribes capital punishment in the law, doesn't it?
It does.
Or at least as a possibility.
That's correct. And the Italians, you know, say that, you know, I mean, they would basically be perfectly happy to look the other way with a lot of CIA antics, but this was so offensive, particularly because of the torture element and because they were obstructing an Italian criminal proceeding, criminal investigation, that they simply couldn't ignore it. It had to be prosecuted.
Okay, so now, it was 23 out of 25 were convicted, but they're all still safe here. It's just they can't ever travel to Europe or Interpol might grab them, something like that?
Yeah, 23 of 26. And I'd say it's not just traveling to Europe. I think they have, in fact, I was just doing an interview with one of them who was telling me that, you know, they've been cautioned not to leave the United States, that basically it's extremely dangerous for them to cross a frontier anywhere. Because you never know what government won't cooperate with a request from the prosecutors. And then the 27 countries that are in the European system, they would be immediately arrested if they sat down in any of those countries.
And which means that they're in how much, I guess, they're in much more legal jeopardy than, say, Rumsfeld from his danger that the Spanish court might get him, huh?
Much more. They've been convicted. They're now officially branded as fugitives from justice. And in fact, the prosecutors went out of their way to demonstrate that during the court. These people are fugitives from justice. They fled Italy because they believed they would be arrested. And they introduced documents, email correspondence that was sent from government officials in Washington to these people telling them, you know, head to the airport right now, get on the next plane and get out of there because you're about to be arrested. You know, so they left the country in order to avoid being arrested. That's the definition of fugitive from justice.
Wow.
And now they're convicted fugitives from justice.
You know, I don't know what else is going on in the news cycle, but it seems like all things being equal, that itself would be the TV movie of the week. This is going on. This would be the biggest deal in the world, right? Is it just there's too many different channels now or what?
Hasn't made that big a splash in the news, I got to say. I mean, I've talked to people at, you know, some of the major news programs. ABC did a big story on this, and NBC was looking at something. But they, in the end, decided that, you know, I mean, healthcare is the flavor of the month. That's what they're really focused on. They don't have the resources to cover this.
I mean, I want a bunch of torturers to be my doctor. It'll be great.
That's right. And one of them told me, well, we'd have to send somebody to Italy to cover it. It'd be so expensive. They're all concerned about counting their pennies right now.
No, wait. Someone at one of the major networks said that to you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Well, they're closing their bureaus overseas, you know.
No, it's an anonymous quote, but I'll trust your judgment on it, Scott.
My response to them was, you know, you can pick up the telephone. You don't actually have to get on a plane and go to Milan.
Oh, man. All right. Well, so, you know, I wanted to ask you something. You mentioned the ABC coverage there. I only saw on Democracy Now! A short clip of an interview by Brian Ross of one of these CIA agents, this woman. And the focus, at least for that segment of it, was that George Bush betrayed these heroic CIA agents who, after all, were only following orders, and that there was something that George Bush should have done more to protect them.
Well, that was Sabrina D'Souza. And in fact, I can tell you, having spoken to a number of people on the list, her attitude is nothing unusual. That's pretty much what they all feel. I mean, that is their... They feel that their reputation has been tarnished. They're now convicted felons. They can never leave the country. And they feel this is all George Bush's fault or the fault of his government. Because this scheme, this snatch, wasn't their idea. Many of them questioned whether it was a sensible thing to do. In fact, Robert Selden Lady, who was the number two person in the deal, we know from other documents, he vehemently opposed this entire thing, saying it was harebrained, stupid, would destroy relations with Italy, etc. All the things he complained about turned out to be correct. So this whole idea came out of Washington and came at very, very high levels. And, you know, one of the complaints you hear from them is that, well, the masterminds behind all this weren't charged and they weren't indicted. And, you know, when I've run that same question by the Italian prosecutors, this is the response I get. yeah, we'd really love to get the masterminds behind this. Of course, we operate in Italy on the basis of evidence. And, you know, we have to have evidence showing that they were the masterminds. And we went after all the people that we had evidence of, you know, their involvement. But, you know, I'm also told that the case is not over as far as they're concerned. And they are very much focused on senior people in Washington who hatched, you know, this criminal plot. And in fact, I was told one name quite specifically, Stephen R. Kappas. He was the head of covert ops at the CIA at the time this thing went down. And right now, he is the number two person in the CIA. And I think the prosecutors suspect very strongly that he was the ultimate mastermind behind this kidnapping plot. And they would love nothing more than to indict him, try him, and convict him, and they think they could do it.
Wow. Well, of course, you know, if it was you or me doing the prosecuting here, the whole purpose of that would still be to get him to flip, turn state's witness, and point the finger at the politicians who are in charge. I can see the frustration of the cops here, where the politicians always get complete immunity, and it's the lower down people, if anyone, who ever get in trouble. And then so the fight becomes immunity for all cops, for all prosecutors, that anyone in government can do anything to anyone, and it's just not fair that any of them should ever be held accountable if George Bush and Dick Cheney aren't able to be held accountable.
But that's a fair enough point. In fact, I'd just flip it around the other way. You know, we look at this case involving Mira Rar, which was decided by the Second Circuit, and compare it with the Italian case, and we have exactly the same issues being raised. So it's a victim of rendition who was tortured for a year, in both cases even the same period of time, who's now seeking compensation, and the government's trying to block it, saying state secrets, you can't reveal state secrets, and then arguing immunity of government actors. And the American courts say, well, immunity, state secrets, you know, we can't even allow this to be heard in the courts. Throw it out. That's what they do. The Italian court looks at it and says, what they were doing in this case with this rendition is a very serious crime. We'll listen to the claim of state secrets, and we'll listen to the claim of immunity, and we're not going to completely reject those things, but only a very limited number of people will be able to take advantage of that. So what happened in the Italian case? We have three people who get immunity, and state secrets, they throw out a lot of the evidence because they say, yes, it's state secrets. But then the case goes forward on the balance. So that's how we get, even though a couple of people were able to make these claims, and a lot of evidence is thrown out, nevertheless, you wound up with convictions. So it's, you know, so it's very, very similar sorts of arguments being made, but a very different result.
Mm. Now, as far as I know, to find a blood relation between you and I, we'd have to go back for, you know, uncounted generations back, and I have no idea how, you know, of my family genealogy that far back at all, beyond, I think, my great-grandfather. But I think you've told me before that it was, what, your great-great-great-uncle or somebody like that actually sat in judgment of King Charles the First, who claimed that he had immunity, I guess, from Jesus.
Well, that's right, yes. I'm descended from the regicide, who was a colonel in the English Civil War, and then was one of the commissioners who tried King Charles. In fact, his signature is in the fifth row, third from the top, on the warrant of execution for King Charles. And you're right, King Charles said, you know, I'm immune. You know, I rule by the divine right of kings. Nobody can hold me accountable. And the commission said no. I mean, he was convicted.
Yeah, well, so I guess that's an outdated process of medieval days, right? That doesn't have anything to do with our advanced civilization now.
Well, it shows how we were more advanced in 1649 than today in the American courts, I think. Because, you know, our whole system basically follows a straight line of succession from the revolutionaries during the English Civil War. I mean, our American revolutionaries view themselves as the successors of Oliver Cromwell and his people, and they view themselves as embracing this idea that no one is above the law, all people are accountable before the law. But what's happened in our country, certainly particularly since the end of World War II with the rise of the national security state, is this creeping reassertion of immunity. Yeah. And it takes us right back to King Charles I and his ideas.
You know, on Glenn Greenwald's blog, he quoted from some of these court opinions, I think from the, I forget if it was a concurrent or it was the majority opinion, and then from the dissent, where the judge, the one judge, says, hey, you know, if the government wants to torture people, who the hell am I to tell them no? And the other judge says, what, are you kidding me? Look, this isn't, you know, some brand new nation experimenting with democracy or something. We already have plenty of real American legal precedent that says it is the absolute duty of a judge to tell the executive that, no, you may not torture people, and watch me do something about it. You know, I mean, we've really taken a few steps backwards from where we were.
Well, that's right. And that judge who wrote that fiery and powerful dissent is the most famous judge on the Second Circuit today. His name is Guido Calabresi. Used to be the dean of Yale Law School. But I'll tell you something else about Dean Calabresi. He's getting way up there in the years. His father and his mother were valiant opponents of fascism in Italy. They're from Milan, the same place as this judge who tried this case. And they stood tall for democracy and opposed the fascist movement there under Benito Mussolini. And as a result of that, they had to flee and come to the United States. And they settled in New Haven, Connecticut, which is where Calabresi was raised and went to school. So he's got this in his genes, you might say.
Yeah, like somebody I know. All right, well, so in the last couple of minutes here, I'm sorry we don't have too much time, Scott, but can you tell me, are you placing bets on the Durham investigation into a few cases of torture all the way to death there, this preliminary investigation, as I think they call it?
Well, the longer it drags on, the more I think he must be coming up with something there.
Oh, yeah. Is that the way you look at that? That's like the jury's been out for 3 days now kind of a thing, huh?
It's like not a quick acquittal. I mean, you know, he's been out looking at this for a long time, and we know he has a grand jury impaneled, and he's been presenting some evidence to them on the tapes disappearance case. So all this is suggesting that, you know, that this is not going to be a case closed.
Wait, let me make sure I understand. You're saying we know that he is taking evidence from his new investigation in front of the grand jury we knew he already had in the case of the videotapes?
He's taking evidence on the videotapes case, but these things are closely tied together, because what are the videotapes tapes of?
Well,
right?
I believe it's already been said, Scott, hadn't it, that he's only looking into cases where people were tortured all the way to death. Do we know that the tapes show that?
We don't know that the tapes show people being, that they're snuff flicks. But we know that they cover some of the people who are the subject of the IG report. So there's definitely this factual connection between the cases. In fact, that's what Eric Holder said when he appointed Durham to handle this matter. He says, you know, he's already handling an investigation which is thematically very close to this. So we're basically just opening the door a little bit. So the investigation he's been doing involving the grand jury already most likely is presenting him with some evidence that's related to the new matters.
I see. All right, now a bigger, probably poorly phrased question. Is it that basically, I mean, the rule of law is a metaphysical concept in time but not space here. Is it simply a matter, Scott, in your opinion, that if enough of the people of a certain society actually believe in and insist upon such a thing, that sort of, you know, draws it into existence, and at some point you can say that there really is such a thing as a rule of law? And how far are we away from that line in your mind, if I phrase that in a coherent manner at all there?
No, you did a great job, in fact. I think we can say, based on viewing recent modern history around the world, that simply having brilliantly written laws doesn't make a rule of law system, and having brilliant judges doesn't make a rule of law system. You have a rule of law system when the citizens of a country take the law seriously. and view it as something earnest and insist on it being observed and performed. And when we have law enforcement agencies that do the same thing, and judges and courts and prosecutors. And all I can say is the United States has been moving in the wrong direction for some time right now. It's been moving in a very cynical direction where politics overtakes the law. And, you know, that happened quite dramatically, I think, over the last 8 years. And under our friend Barack Obama, we hear all this wonderful, noble rhetoric, but, you know, we really haven't seen anything of substance to turn the situation around. Look at the state secrets issues. But I tell you one good thing on the state secrets front. Yesterday, the government announced a settlement in one of these state secret suits in which it's paying $3 million to the plaintiff.
Wow.
Yeah, this was the case involving the DEA agent in Burma who discovered that he was being taped with a bug planted in his coffee table. And the judge, Royce Lambert, who was handling the case, ordered the Justice Department to turn over classified documents. And they had a complete fit about this. And the result is the Justice Department's going to pay the guy off to get a settlement. So this is very, very important precedent for all of these unlawful surveillance cases.
Meaning that further lawyers will be able to go to court and say, but judge, this other judge already said this and that in this other case.
Basically he said, yeah, you may be forced to turn over classified documents, notwithstanding state secrecy. You may have to share this stuff with the defense counsel. And yes, indeed, the government may have to pay monetary damages to resolve these cases.
Wow. And so, I guess, but the opposite thing was, or maybe it hadn't been decided yet, that it's, the story I believe is the Obama administration, the Holder Justice Department, is taking the argument anyway in court that George Bush's, you know, it's not torture, so we always put it on the back burner, right? But his millions of counts, a self-admitted, bragged guilt on millions of counts of violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, that Obama is continuing to argue that that is all secret, that is all privileged, the law may not apply to that. Is that correct?
Absolutely right. But this precedent dealing with the DEA agent, it really is very, very dangerous for them, is very powerful. And I think, frankly, the fact that they're settling it, making a payout, isn't going to help them in the end of the day. It's going to be looked at by other judges around the country that, you know, the Justice Department is acknowledging potential exposure and liability. And we have one of the most conservative judges, one of the real experts on the bench in intelligence law, Royce Lambert, who was the presiding judge of the FISA court for many years, saying that, yes, indeed, the government can be compelled to turn over these underlying classified documents. You know, vital precedents here. So I think they, you know, the government's just lost that this is now the third in a row big case they've lost.
Well, I'm so glad we have you chronicling all this for us, Scott. I really appreciate your time on the show today and all your writing, especially at harpers.org there.
Great to be with you.
All right, folks, that is the other Scott Horton, heroic international human rights anti-torture lawyer, legal affairs correspondent for Harper's Magazine, professor at Columbia and Hofstra Law Schools, and that's it for Anti-War Radio today.